referencing from this sutta to another sutta, sutta number 39 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is the Maha Asapura Sutta, which has a little bit of elaboration and then similes to illustrate the state of the jhana. And so we come to page 367, paragraph 15. Here we start off with the same formula, having abandoned these five hindrances, and so on, up to with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. But now the text continues. He, that is the meditating monk, makes the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion drench, steep, fill and pervade this body, that is, this physical body, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. That is, the state of jhana is the rapture and pleasure are so pervasive and so intense that it is as if they are pervading the entire body, even from the top of the head to the tips of the toes. And then to illustrate this, a simile is used. Just as a skilled bathman or a bathman's apprentice heaps bath powder in a metal basin and sprinkling it gradually with water, kneads it until the moisture wets his ball of bath powder, soaks it and pervades it inside and out, yet the ball itself does not ooze. So too the bhikkhu makes the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. And so sometimes, like, people get the idea that in Buddhism, practicing Buddhism, one is supposed to avoid any kind of joy or pleasure, just keep equanimity. But in fact, in the early stages, one has to consciously develop this rapture, bliss, pleasure, extend it, intensify it, and even make it pervade the whole body. That's a way of drawing the mind, as I said last week, drawing the mind away from its infatuation with the lower pleasures, the pleasures of sensuality, and leading it on to, step by step, to higher and higher, more refined pleasures, then eventually cutting the subtle attachment to that, those pleasures, and pushing it eventually to the ultimate bliss of Nibbana. And now the simile, okay, this, maybe men who shave with a brush, maybe we don't do this anymore, now we have these aerosol, but I never use them because I don't like them, these aerosol foam cans. But in the old days, they used to take this powder, soap powder, put it in a little basin, put water in, use a brush, roll the brush around till it becomes a ball of soap, then use that soap for shaving. So you get this ball of soap in which the water and soap are completely blended together, so that there's no bit of soap which is not pervaded by water, and no water dripping out from the soap. And so that's the way one has to cultivate this rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. But the simile gives the impression that this is taking place in the jhana. And that way the simile is not precise. In the stages leading up to the jhana, one builds up that rapture and pleasure and extends it, because then one is making a conscious, deliberate effort to expand, to intensify the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. But when the mind goes into the jhana, then it's a kind of solid state of just unflickering, undisturbed, thoughtless pleasure and rapture and pleasure. There's no more conscious deliberation of extending or pervading in the jhana itself. Okay, so now, after attaining the first jhana, if you just read, the Buddha goes on and says, now we're coming back to sutta number 27, paragraph 19. The Buddha says, this Brahman is called a footprint of the Tathagata. Now, coming back to the simile of the tracking the elephant down by its footprint. So now we're trying to track the Tathagata to see what the Buddha is like. And so now we see a footprint of the Tathagata. Since this is when the Buddha attained his enlightenment, this was on that night of his enlightenment, the first step that he took towards the enlightenment was the attainment of the first jhana. So it's something scraped by the Tathagata, something marked by the Tathagata, but the noble disciple doesn't yet conclude that the Buddha is fully enlightened, the Dhamma is well proclaimed, the Sangha is practicing the good way. The reason, as we said last week, because those who are not fully enlightened can attain the jhanas. Even non-Buddhist ascetics can attain the jhanas. So the jhana is a necessary condition for being a Sammasambuddha, a fully enlightened Buddha, but it's not proof that one is a Buddha, the fact that one has attained the jhana. Okay, now if you just read the sutta, you get the impression that as soon as one achieves the first jhana, one goes on immediately to attain the second jhana. But actually, if one reads other suttas and gets a picture of the teaching as a whole, one sees that before going on to attain the second jhana, one has to master the lower jhana. Before one goes on to attain a higher jhana, one has to master a lower jhana that one has achieved. To master a lower jhana, certain skills are necessary. In the Jhana Samyutta, this is chapter 34 of the Samyutta Nikaya, the text speaks of a number of skills, something like 11, 12 skills. The most important being able to attain the jhana easily, to enter easily. Just when one wants to enter, one can enter the jhana, so that one doesn't have to struggle with difficulty, with effort to enter. But one makes the decision to enter, one can enter very easily. It's called samapatti kusala. Then one can sustain, maintain the jhana for as long a time as one wants. If one wants to remain in the jhana 5 minutes, one will be in for 5 minutes. Half an hour, one will be in a half an hour. An hour, one will be in an hour. One wants to extend it for 2 hours, 3 hours, one can do so. And then another important skill is being able to emerge when one wants. One makes a predetermination I will emerge at such and such a time, and then one will emerge according to one's determination. If one enters at 4 o'clock and says, I want to come out at 5 o'clock, one doesn't have to set a little beeper to go beep, 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 beep. But one doesn't have to look at the watch. But just one comes, as soon as the clock turns 5, one just comes out spontaneously. Okay, maybe to gain the second jhana, one doesn't have to have that extraordinary mastery, but one has to have a fair degree, one is encouraged to have a fair degree of experience, let's say experience with the first jhana, to attain it over and over, so one becomes very familiar with it. Then as one becomes familiar with the first jhana, one begins to see that as joyful, as blissful as the state is, it still has certain imperfection to it. And what is that imperfection? It is flawed by the presence of vitakka and vichara, this mental application and sustained thought or examination. These are seen to be gross factors. They're still cast a very light shadow upon the state. It's not yet a state of perfect samadhi, perfect concentration. And since one is familiar with the teaching on the jhanas, one knows that there is a state beyond this. And so one has a strong aspiration for the fading away of vitakka and vichara. And so one makes a determination to attain that state, that second jhana, in which vitakka and vichara have faded away. And so one goes on strengthening one's faculty of concentration, practicing with one's meditation object, and then when one's faculty of concentration is strong enough, then one goes into the first jhana, and then at a certain point through the strength of the faculty of concentration, then applied and sustained thought subsides, and one enters into the second jhana. And then this is described in the formula. Here I don't quite like the translation. It says, which has self-confidence and singleness of mind without applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of concentration. The Pali here, self-confidence, it's somewhat misleading. It's not self-confidence like an athlete who's confident of himself, or a business executive who has self-confidence. But the Pali word term is ajatang sampasadhanam, which means more precisely it's internally, that's ajatang sampasadhanam, which has internal tranquilization. And what is meant is the tranquilization, the stilling, the subsiding of, or the tranquility that results through the subsiding of applied and sustained thought. Applied and sustained thought are that degree of disturbance that remains even in the first jhana. And so when they applied and sustained thought come to an end, then there's this internal tranquilization. And then there's this singleness of mind, chaitaso ekodi bhavang, that's the unification of mind, the very strong samadhi. And that comes because there is no more applied and sustained thought. And now there is rapture and pleasure. Notice the expression here, rapture and pleasure, born of concentration. In the formula of the first jhana, you just look up at paragraph 19, one has rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. The rapture and pleasure that arise through seclusion from the five hindrances. But now the five hindrances have been left far behind, and so now one has a more refined rapture and pleasure that are born through the power of samadhi itself. This is samadhi jang piti sukham. The rapture and pleasure born of concentration. Then turning to sutta number 39. This is page 368, paragraph 16. The text continues, he makes the rapture and pleasure born of concentration drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of concentration. Just, now we come to the simile, very beautiful simile. Just as though there were a lake whose waters welled up from below, and it had no inflow from the east, west, north, or south, and it would not be replenished from time to time by showers of rain, then the cool fount of water welling up in the lake would make the cool water drench, steep, fill, and pervade the lake so that there would be no part of the whole lake unpervaded by cool water. So too a bhikkhu makes the rapture and pleasure born of concentration drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of concentration. So we have this very, very beautiful image of the lake. So I can't imagine a lake which is not filled with water from any external source, but it has a fount of water coming up from below, and that cool water just pervades all, that fount of water coming up from below pervades all the water in the lake. Drenches, steeps, fills, and pervades the lake, that the whole lake gets pervaded by that cool water. In the same way as that, it's like a font of rapture and bliss coming up and pervading the body of the meditator in the second jhana. And this too is called a footprint of the Tathagata, but a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion that the Blessed One is fully enlightened. Okay, we come now, the meditator, again, he has to become familiar with the jhana, master it to a certain extent, experience it again and again, and as he experiences the jhana, becomes familiar with it, In the early stages, it seems so much more peaceful, so much more wonderful than the first jhana, because applied thought and sustained thought have been eliminated. But now, as one becomes increasingly familiar with the second jhana, one notices that this has an imperfection too. And that imperfection is the presence of piti, rapture. Because rapture, the nature of rapture is something like excitement, elation, exhilaration. It's not a completely tranquil or peaceful state. And so the mind is bubbling with this excitement of rapture. It's not completely tranquil, settled down. And so the meditator will be aware that there is a state beyond the second jhana in which there is no rapture. That is the third jhana. And he'll make an aspiration, he'll develop an aspiration for the third jhana, form a determination to enter the third jhana, and go on practicing with the meditation object, strengthening the faculty of concentration, until he can make that rapture fade away. This is pityacha viraga, with the fading away of rapture. Then in the formula now, we see certain other qualities now come to prominence. As rapture fades away, it says that the monk abides in equanimity. In the earlier formulas, equanimity was not mentioned. Now, upekako cha viharati. So he abides equanimous, because now that disturbance from joy, from rapture, is gone. So the mind is more balanced, more even, more composed. And now in developing all the jhanas, there had to be mindfulness and clear comprehension, but they weren't mentioned in the formulas for the first two jhanas, because their functions were somewhat subordinate. Because they were overpowered, their functions were overpowered by the other factors. But now in the third jhana, mindfulness and clear comprehension come to prominence. And now he's still feeling pleasure with the body, he's experiencing this bliss, pleasure, and he enters and dwells and abides in the third jhana, of which the noble ones announce he has a pleasant abiding, who has equanimity and is mindful. See, now equanimity and mindfulness are becoming increasingly more prominent. And we go ahead to Sutta 39. This is now paragraph 17. Continue from about the fifth line down, sixth line down. He makes the pleasure divested of rapture. You see the way this is now described? This is nipitika sukham, I think it is. Nipitikam sukham. This is the sukha. This is the pleasure, happiness, or bliss without rapture, without that exhilaration or excitement of joy. So he makes that pleasure divested of rapture, drenched, steeped, fill and pervade this body so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the pleasure divested of rapture. Then another very lovely simile. Just as in a pond of blue or red or white lotuses, some lotuses that are born and grow in the water thrive immersed in the water without rising out of it. And cool water drenches, steeps, fills, and pervades them to their tips and their roots, so that there is no part of all those lotuses unpervaded by cool water. So too a bhikkhu makes the pleasure divested of rapture drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the pleasure divested of rapture. And now it seems as if that bliss of the jhana is covering the entire body, so that the entire body is just immersed within that bliss. And so coming back to page 275, this too, Brahman, is called a footprint of the Tathagata, but a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion the Blessed One is fully enlightened, and so on. Okay, now the meditator masters the third jhana. He becomes thoroughly familiar with it. Is able to attain it very often. And as he does so, then he will notice that even the third jhana has a certain defect. And that is the feeling of the third jhana, that particular felt quality, is one of pleasure or bliss. And pleasure or bliss is close to attachment. It is an object of attachment. We use that sublime or very refined pleasure or bliss of the jhanas to draw the mind away from the lower pleasures, the pleasures of sensuality. But now that we've come to the third jhana and mastered it, now one begins to see that this feeling of the third jhana, this very refined state, feeling of pleasure or bliss, is still subject to a very subtle attachment. So it's not as pure, as refined, as the feeling of, it's called the equanimous feeling, or neutral feeling, the feeling which is neither pleasant nor painful, that is present in the fourth jhana. Now, according to the Buddhist analysis of feelings, there are three types of feelings. Here I have to do a little diagramming.
Is this... See that one? I can't erase anything. It's finished?
Okay, so now the meditator sees that the feelings which come in these pairs of opposites pleasure and pain, these are bodily pleasure, bodily pain, and mental joy, mental grief or sadness. Those feelings are imperfect, out of balance, because they always have to come in these pairs of opposites. And beyond them, there is a state of neutral feeling, equanimous feeling, a state of neither, which is beyond pleasure and pain, beyond joy and grief. And that is the feeling in the fourth jhana. And so the meditator now makes the determination, first he arouses the aspiration for the fourth jhana, then makes the aspiration for the fourth jhana. He arouses the aspiration for the fourth jhana, makes the determination to enter it, then undertakes the practice, and when his faculties are mature enough, then with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, now he's overcoming the subtle pleasure, the experience of pleasure with the body that remained even in the third jhana. And earlier he had overcome painful bodily feelings. And earlier he had overcome joy and grief. Now he enters and dwells in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure. It has that fifth type of feeling, which is called neither painful nor pleasant feeling. And it has purity of mindfulness, which is due to the presence of equanimity. It said that mindfulness is present throughout the whole process of developing jhana, but all the other factors in the jhana, in the lower jhanas, obscured the purity of mindfulness because they prevented perfect equanimity. But now, when there is this neutral feeling, this feeling of neither pain nor pleasure, then the equanimity reaches its peak. And when equanimity reaches its peak, then mindfulness reaches its fullness of purity. This is somewhat like we have the moon in the sky, but if there is the sun, some degree of sunlight, we can't really see the beauty of the moon, the full moon. But when it's a perfectly dark night, no degree of sunlight at all in the sky, then you could see the bright, shining, pure, full moon. So when there's no degree of any pleasure, pain, joy, or grief in the mind of the meditator, when the equanimity is perfectly balanced, that is like the darkness of the sky. And then the purity of mindfulness, that is like the bright, shining, radiant full moon. Okay, then we turn now to Sutta 39, the simile for the fourth jhana. This is page 368, paragraph 18, very bottom of the page. Okay, he sits, okay, after developing this purity of mindfulness due to equanimity, he sits pervading this body with a pure, bright mind, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the pure, bright mind. And now the simile. Just as though a man were sitting covered from the head down with a white cloth, so that there would be no part of his whole body unpervaded by the white cloth, so too a bhikkhu sits pervading this body with a pure, bright mind, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the pure, bright mind. Okay, so now in this fourth jhana, the mind has become very bright, pure, radiant, free from any disturbance by, even by this very refined pleasure and bliss of the third jhana. So equanimity is now reached its fullness, mindfulness has reached its fullness, and the mind is radiant, very subtle. And that bright, radiant mind is now pervading the entire body. And then back to page 276. This too, Brahman, is called a footprint of the Tathagata. But a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion that the Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha is practicing the good way. Okay, maybe at this point I should stop and ask if there are any questions. Yeah. 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 Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, within the jhana itself, there's no conscious deliberation. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's not done through a conscious deliberation, but it's through the force of the concentration that builds up. Through the force of prior effort, and the concentration develops a certain momentum so that it just moves the mind from the lower jhana into the higher jhana. That would be my understanding of it. So my understanding differs somewhat in this respect from the commentaries, I have to say. That the commentaries explain that to go into a higher jhana, one always has to come back to a normal consciousness and then make a determination to go into the higher jhana. But the way I see it explained in the suttas, one goes directly from a lower jhana into a higher jhana. And that's the way I've seen it explained by some meditators who I feel confident. Yeah. Yeah, that one has to come out and make a determination for that. Yeah. 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 I didn't quite understand what the question has to do with meditators outside the field of yeah. One has to have some knowledge that there is You mean, so how is the point of the question, say, how would a non-Buddhist meditator who is not aware of these particular stages of jhana, after getting into a first jhanic state, say, become aware that there is some higher state beyond that? The question I don't really feel qualified to answer, but I would just, as a conjecture, say that within these different systems, there could have been like rishis and sages from old who just managed through, perhaps from coming into the human world from higher Brahma. It becomes a chicken and egg type issue. Okay, so they come into the human world from higher Brahma world. They have lived, say, in a fourth jhanic Brahma world previously, come back into this realm, and then since their mind has been strongly conditioned by existence of that realm, once they start to meditate, then they spontaneously or very quickly go into a fourth jhanic state. Okay, and then they're able to teach methods to achieve that state to their disciples, and then they take that to be the supreme attainment. And so then they can guide their disciples through, they might not use the words first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, but they can guide them through the stages. They'll describe these stages. Even Christian mystics, if you read Christian mystics like St. Teresa, St. John of the Cross, they describe stages which correspond very closely to the jhanic stages. They don't use the expressions first jhana, second jhana, but they'll speak about stages in which you could see that there's a certain degree of thought present, and they'll speak about how one drops the thinking and one just remains in this thoughtless rapture and bliss. And so they have, it just seems to come as a kind of almost a natural meditative unfolding. So one doesn't see what seems to be the barrier of seeing into the conditioned and ultimately impermanent, unsatisfactory nature of these states, that they're just dependently originated, conditioned, anicca, dukkha, that's like the Buddha's original contribution to the understanding of these states. Sukhi. Yeah. 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 Mm. Mm. Yeah. 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 Well, I would say that the mindfulness and the sampajanya do contribute to lead one to the next step. I wouldn't say that just that they themselves lead one to the next step. Yeah. 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 Yeah, that wakefulness jagariya, you could see the way it's described. It's describing somebody who's practicing meditation very diligently. That person practices the meditation continuously during the day, walking, doing periods of walking meditation, sitting meditation, walking meditation. Then during the first watch of the night, that would be 6 p.m. to 10 p.m., again continues practicing walking and sitting. Then lies down mindfully during the middle watch of the night in the lion's posture. That's with lying on the right side, one foot on top of the other, having determined in the mind the time for rising. And then gets up in the first watch of the, in the third watch of the night, maybe perhaps 3 a.m., 2 a.m., 3 a.m., and then continues the practice. So that means keeping awake as much as possible. So it's not the same as mindfulness. Yeah. Yeah. Adukha Masukha. Yeah. It's that M is just, it's called a euphonic consonant. It's just put in order to fill a gap between two A's. Yeah. The mindfulness is what holds one, and the concentration. Yeah. One doesn't, at that point one doesn't need vitakka to hold one to the meditation object. The vitakka, the applied thought, is necessary in the initial stages. That's what directs the mind to the object. And then in the first jhana, vitakka is what keeps the mind holding to the object. But then once the mind becomes fixed on the object through vitakka and vichara, then vitakka vichara can drop off, and then the mind will still stay on the object through all the other factors. So one doesn't have to worry it's not going to lose the object. Yeah, it's a momentum, that's a good word. Yeah. It's a little bit like saying, you know, when children learn to ride the bicycle, they go from the tricycle to two-wheeling bicycle, and then they have, I remember we used to have training wheels. Then you say, what happens when you take the training wheels off? What is going to hold you up? The child will ask, what's going to hold you up when we take the Mommy, what's going to hold me up when you take the training wheels off? The bicycle's going to fall off and I'll collapse onto the ground. But you say, you build up the momentum and then the two wheels will hold you up. You don't need the training wheels anymore. There's nothing like an agent in the sense of a self directing the mind. It's just sort of looked at in the philosophical way. It's just determination as a mental factor directing the mind. But looked at in the conventional way of speaking, it's you yourself direct the mind. You know, the trouble with the word awareness is that it can be used as it's used here, you mean? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you see, what is translated here as full awareness, that is sampajanya. And now I prefer now to render sampajanya as clear comprehension. Then in an earlier class, about 2-3 weeks ago, I gave an explanation about sampajanya. And so some people render, see, the Pali terms have pretty, quite precise meaning. But when you come to the English word awareness, some people use it to render sati, but we render mindfulness, they use awareness. Then others, like Venerable Nyanamoli, use awareness for sampajanya, and I let it stand here, but I don't like that because it creates a confusion. Then other people use awareness for, even for citta, for consciousness. What is consciousness? But I explain it that way. What is consciousness? The awareness of an object. And so awareness can mean everything from an ant responding to a stimuli. It's aware of the stimulus. To a Buddha's sabbatisanyana is all embracing awareness. Yeah, that's a good question, a very good question. In the initial stages, one would have to go from the first to the second, from the second to the third, to the third to the fourth. But after one gets experience of the jhanas and then masters them, and then there are four beyond this, the four formless meditations, and once one masters those, then one can, like a juggler juggling balls, one can go from one to another to another to another, and then there are the 10 casinos. This is the training that's given in the monastery in Burma for developing the abhinyas, the supernormal powers. What you have to do is be able to go from the first jhana to the eighth meditation in forward order, then down, using one of the casinos, up, down, up, down, then take it with the second casino, up, down, up, down, then go through all eight casinos. Then eventually one has to get the skill to be able to go in first jhana with one casino, second jhana with the next casino, third jhana with the third casino, fourth casino with the fourth. Just do it per second like that. Split second. So one just puts the mind in, out, then comes second jhana, second casino, third jhana, third casino, fourth jhana, fourth casino. So the mind becomes very quick, very subtle. Then on that basis, then one could start developing the supernormal powers. With practical exercise. A weekend seminar. Excuse me? Yeah. It said that it all took place in one night. He would have gone into the jhanas. no, to my knowledge, no time, temporal explanation is given of how much time he spent in each jhana. But it says that in the first watch of the night, then he developed the first, we'll come to these next week, the first direct knowledge, that's the recollection of previous lives. The middle watch of the night, he developed the divine eye by which he could see the passing away and rebirth of beings. Then in the last watch of the night, he developed the knowledge of the destruction of the defilement. Well, he had this experience, childhood experience of the first jhana. And then, this is a strange thing, when he practiced, when he first became an ascetic, when he first renounced the household life, he trained under some meditation teachers, and he would have attained the third formless attainment, and then the fourth, the last formless attainment, under these two teachers. But no mention is made in the text of him practicing the jhanas under those teachers. But in order to achieve the third formless attainment and fourth formless attainment, it would seem that one has to go through the jhanas. So it's been a puzzle to me. So I've given various interpretations, theories to try to explain why he should recollect his experience of the first jhana as a child. Why didn't he recollect the jhana practicing under those two teachers? The texts don't give any explanation of this. In fact, they don't even raise it as a question. Something I wanted to say that Eva's question brought up, and that is, actually, to go to the destruction of the defilements, one doesn't have to go even to the fourth jhana. One could go from the first jhana to the destruction of the defilement. Access to the destruction of the defilement, this is the point about which there's some difference of opinion or controversy. According to the commentaries, this is in the Theravada system, the Theravada commentaries, one can develop access concentration without attaining jhana and then develop insight knowledge, even to the extent of reaching arhatship. And these are what they call dry-visioned arhats. You know this expression? Is there such a system in the Chinese Savasthivada? I think in the Savasthivada system there's something like that too. So they don't achieve jhana, but just on the basis of access concentration, they develop insight and reach destruction of the defilement. That's why it's called dry vision, that their insight is not moistened by the softening influence of the jhanas. But the way, if you just take the suttas without the commentaries, they seem to be saying, as I read them, this is my interpretation, and I have written an article. And if Peter disagrees with me, he might burn up that book. Then I lose my copy of the article. Of the four stages of, according to the early Buddha system, four stages of liberation, in my understanding, one could reach the first two stages, stream entry, once returning, without jhana. But to go from the second to the third, it seems that jhana becomes necessary. I think it's possible in that article I say that there might be another way that's even acknowledged in the text. But some suttas seem to lay it down to go from the second to the third jhana becomes necessary. And if that's the case, then to reach the fourth stage, arhatship jhana becomes necessary. Okay, if only one question, that will be the last. Don't have to take them. Yes. Yeah. It's quite possible that he attains it without knowing. He might not have any definite way to know. There's not a definite way to know. He could be mistaken. He could even reach access and think this is the jhana. He might be mistaken. So the good way is if one has access to a teacher who really one knows, one has confidence, has experience on it, then one could check with him. And then, of course, he could be mistaken in judging one's own experience. So there's a lot of room for mistakes, that's all. Okay. We do the dedication, the sharing of the merit. Okay, we share our merits with the devas, the gods, the nagas, the protective dragon spirits, asking them to rejoice in the merit, to protect the Buddha's teaching, to protect the exposition of the teaching, to protect ourselves and others. Then we share the merits. Again, we ask the devas to rejoice in the merit and achieve all success. We ask the Buddhas, the harmful spirits, to rejoice in the merit and achieve all success. And we invite all beings to rejoice in the merit and achieve all success. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu mangparam. Etavata caam hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata caam hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata caam mehi sampadam punya.